This is The Guardian.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One year ago this week.
Мною принято решение о проведении специальной военной операции.
The vehicles are clearly now moving forward towards the territory of Ukraine.
Tonight at 6, we're live in Ukraine and the country at war after a huge Russian military offensive by land, sea and air.
The world watched as Russia invaded Ukraine. And while some predicted that Vladimir Putin's forces would win in a matter of weeks, that's really not what we've seen.
When President Putin ordered his tanks to roll into Ukraine, he thought we would roll over. He was wrong. Democracy was too strong.
So, on the anniversary of the invasion, where are we now? How has the war changed the world? And what's next for Russia and Ukraine? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Today, we'll be focusing on Ukraine. How has Russia's invasion of the country changed our politics and politics in the world more widely? And just a warning, this episode contains descriptions of war that some listeners may find upsetting. Friday this week marks the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. A year ago, the world watched as Russian troops began what was described by Vladimir Putin at the time as a military exercise. What followed on from that marked the first time we've seen war in Europe for decades, with millions of Ukrainians now displaced, thousands of lives lost, endless reports of Russian atrocities, and a very different global picture from what we knew this time last year. Now, when we started this new incarnation of Politics Weekly a year ago, I suppose we thought we'd be talking week in, week out about domestic affairs in the UK, but that wasn't how it turned out. Straight away, we explored the war in Ukraine, what it meant and where it was going. And one of the first people we spoke to, massively powerfully, was the Ukrainian Member of Parliament, Kira Ruddick. And I'm pleased to say she's going to join us again and talk about life and politics and what the war looks like right now. Right, thank you so much. Obviously, Kira, we spoke a year ago, almost, I think. And, you know, it's important that we speak to you now and get a sense of how things have changed and how you feel about what's happened since we last spoke. And what's going to happen in the future and all that stuff. Tell me, first of all, how you are, how you feel about the war right now. And I wonder as well whether a year ago you would have predicted a war of this length.
Well, first of all, I think nobody could have predicted the war of this length or just like that we will still be here. A year ago, we knew that it was not given. So right now we are treating it as a huge gift. Just the fact that we are here and we are alive. And this is probably one of the main lessons. I'm fine. I'm in Kyiv. Kyiv is not surrounded. We are still living with the curfew 11 p.m. till 5 a.m. We see that we have made like a tremendous journey since the last year. And nobody could have predicted that the war would be so long, but also nobody could have predicted how the world's attitude towards Ukraine changed. We have gone through so many things that were deemed impossible in the past, starting from nobody believing in our survival for more than a couple of days, then getting the heavy weapons, then going on to counteroffense and actually regaining half of the territories that Russia was able to capture. Every single time we are thinking anything is impossible, with the right proper push, we are able to make it happen.
Just tell me about your day-to-day life as a member of parliament now.
So parliament is gathering at least once in 2 weeks. We are gathering in secrecy, so we are not announcing it in advance. We usually vote for a number of items in a couple of important directions. The first one is to do everything that the military asks us. And second is our journey to become a member of EU. The third point is, of course, the humanitarian infrastructure, economical direction, where we have to make sure that our economy does not completely die. And the fourth direction is fighting Russian propaganda, fighting Russian influence. And it's like really important direction that we have been worked on. My everyday life as a person is rather, you wake up, you check if you have electricity, if you have heat, and if you have running water. This is the first check. Many times you wake up to the air raid sirens, and so you have like the last hour of sleep from under the stairs where we hide since the day one of the full-scale invasion. There we have like cereals and everything to have like breakfast. We have the lights turned on all the times because when the electricity gets on, and sometimes it's like 2 a.m. or 3 a.m., you have to get up quickly and start doing everything around the house. Like start your washing machine, dishwasher, everything, and be very quickly because it may not last for long. This winter has been very hard on us, it's true.
Okay. Let me ask you about the experiences of people perhaps elsewhere in Ukraine. We read a lot, we hear a lot about awful atrocities committed by Russian forces, human rights abuses, the use of rape as a weapon of war, children disappearing from Ukraine. I wonder how much is that in people's thoughts? Because I suppose everybody must know somebody in those parts of Ukraine who's been directly affected by those things.
Everybody has either been to the funeral of somebody he did know personally or somebody he would know like a second hand. You know, I have been to Bucha and Irpin first day after liberation. I have seen the atrocities and the results of it firsthand, the mass graves, the dead bodies of the women who were tried to be burned to cover for what had happened to them when they were alive. And I met and spoke with women who were victims of the sexual violence. It is so terrifying that things like this can happen in 21st century. And we know that these atrocities, they happen to people at the occupied territories right now when we are speaking. Probably the most terrifying image that I have seen in this war was this box of dental crowns found in one of the torture rooms in Izum. I have only seen something like this in Auschwitz. And it's still hard to process that people like us, we used to speak like same language as them, would do something like that to us.
That, I would imagine, leads to a sort of state of trauma. As you say, it's impossible to process those things. And yet, day in, day out, people have to be determined and focused enough to carry on the war. That must be hard, combining those things.
You know, it's... You're every single day, you are going through so many extremely good and extremely bad things that you just have to find a way for yourself and for your family to stay sane. I think because we learned that tomorrow is not given and that you cannot plan for more than like a week, you try to stay stable for as long as it's possible because so many people depend on you. Rely on you, especially during this winter when it's just physical survival, right? To have heat, to make sure like that your family is safe, to make sure that you have electricity, to make sure that you have all the medicines bought in advance in case there are like interruptions, all the other things. And so you have just to go on. I think it will hit us when there would be peace, when would there would be victory. But right now, having trauma is quite a luxury that you have to, that you cannot allow yourself.
Let me ask you some questions about people outside Ukraine, the international response to the war, and words recently spoken by one of the belligerents, Vladimir Putin. So let's start with him. Did you see Putin's speech yesterday?
Yes.
Tell me what you made of it.
Well, you know, right now we are at this situation where the world finally sees what we have seen for 9 years, that Russia is fighting not because like they need new territories. They are fighting because it's their like mission to restore them, the empire. And this is why they cannot be trusted. And everybody who thinks, oh, we can hush-hush them is just wrong, because their mission is to expand. Their mission is to destroy, because it resolves all the issues inside the country. So every single time somebody says, oh, Putin finally is a bad guy, or Putin cannot be trusted, or look, Putin withdraws from international agreements, we are just like, huh? We have been saying this for so long. It took you like 9 years to see that. And right now it takes so many people to die to the world see what we have been saying for so long. So yesterday it was like another, we have told you so.
What about Joe Biden and what he said in Warsaw, and indeed his visit to Kyiv? Because there's a lot of political sort of show business involved in that, right? But at the same time, it means something. And I wonder what you think it does mean.
We run on hope. Right. And I keep saying that our main fuel on like getting day to day is hope. And President Biden gave us like another chunk of it. It was powerful. And it was like another push for us to not lose the hope and make sure that we will, that the international community will stay with us. Plus, it was, you know, emotionally, it was good because Putin wanted to have parade on our streets. And now a year in, Biden is walking there.
Right. Yeah, that's very symbolic.
Yeah,
right.
It is symbolic. And plus, yeah. He came here and 9 years anniversary when Putin's forces started occupying Crimea. And for us, it was super symbolic, saying it did not start a year ago. It started 9 years ago. And it was the international community that was looking aside when he was doing what he was doing. And now the international community is stepping up.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. When we spoke a year ago, I think it's fair to say you were angry about the lack of help from the wider international community. How do you feel now?
I feel like the progress have been tremendous, but it is still a little bit too late, everything that is happening. Like with the tanks, we are getting them, but we are getting them like in summer. My main question again, are we going to be here in summer? You see, the issue is that there are two sides. The first one is what we are getting for the front, so we can push Russia back and stand and fight. And another set is what we are getting for the civilian population.
Right.
And this is the jets, because we need them. So every single time there is an attack on us, the terrorist attack, we have like more chances to survive. And it's so hard to tell people, to explain to them what you feel when you're sitting under the stairs and they say like 60 missiles are on the way to Kyiv. And you just like, dear God, please. First you say, let it not be me. And then you say, let it not be anybody, because you know the frustration. And there are weapons in the world that can help us, can save us. Right. And it's still with all the words, with all the support, with all the confirmations, we still are not getting them. And the question is like, why?
One thing runs through a great deal of what you've said to me today, which is the matter of urgency. That it seems to me, and I'm not the only person who said this, this is a sort of a standard thing in commentary about the war, that if Ukraine is going to win, it has to happen quite quickly. I wonder, do you feel that yourself, that there is a huge question of urgency hanging over this, that speed is really, really important?
Yes, I think it's probably the most important. if the call for the last year was, please help us, today the call is, please help us ASAP. Yeah. Because it's like Putin's game, and he is not hiding it. It's Putin's game to make it like a war of attrition, to wait for political changes in the country's lives, to wait for the exhaustion, to wait for like another opportunity for him. We need to win the war ASAP. Every single day matters. Every single hour matters. And there is nothing more painful than somebody saying, oh, we will do it in 2 or 3 weeks. Because again, the question is, like, how one can say that we have 2 or 3 weeks? We do not.
Let me ask you about what it is to win. We've used that word quite a lot, but we haven't gone into the details of what that might represent. Tell me what your sense is of what Ukraine winning this war would look like. And in a detailed sense, as regards territory as much as anything else.
So our goal and our aim is to get to the borders of 1991.
And that obviously, for anyone listening, clearly that includes Crimea. That's the central point, or among the central points.
Crimea is Ukraine.
Right.
The second point is to make sure that Russia would not attack us again. And this is a tricky one, because even if, imagine that we are already at the borders of 1991, it doesn't mean that Russia would stop fighting, right? It doesn't mean that even with the regime change there, they would not have like, oh, it was just Putin who wasn't doing the things wrong. Let's get together and fight it. Because it is in the core of their national idea, imperialism. And so the second and the probably key question would be, how do we make sure that our children would not have to fight the same war that we do? And believe me, we would do everything that they would not have to fight it. And the question is, as of right now, as a year ago, there is still not an organization or a person or a world leader who would say, okay, we'll make sure that Putin keeps his word if there is a peace deal. Nobody, none.
So in other words, it's still unclear what the method of collective security would be that ensured that a settlement would last. That still has a huge question mark hanging over
yes.
it.
Yes. And this is why the most secure way for us to survive is for Russia to collapse, as Soviet Union collapsed, into a national state.
It's not going to happen, is it?
Well, nobody believed that Soviet Union will collapse. This is our hope. Honestly, as of right now, the main hope.
That may be your hope, but at the same time, perhaps speaking realistically, at some stage, Ukraine will have to negotiate with Russia, and you very well may not get what you want.
Well, again, for 8 years, we have been in this like negotiating state, and we have seen what it has done to us. They just gathered more forces and attacked us. So this is not something that Ukrainians will take, at least not right now. We still have it in us to fight. And I do hope that we will have lots of this energy to fight back, because we know that Russia just would not keep their word.
Okay. Last question. Just give me a sense of how you feel about the immediate future.
I do not plan for more than a week, but I also am very hopeful with what we can achieve with the new supplies of the weapons. I do hope that Putin will lose his hopes on the offensive in spring, and instead we will go on counteroffensive. At least this is the feel that we get, that we need to use this momentum right now and this rage that we turn into fight. And I think probably one of the most important things that happened over this year is the Western allies stopped playing reactive. You know, Putin does this, okay, we will do additional sanctions. Putin does this, okay, we will give you some more of the weapons. They started playing the first hand, saying, okay, Ukraine will win. Now we need to change it to Ukraine will win soon. Ukraine will win ASAP. This is the goal.
Ukraine will win soon. On that note, we will let you go. Thank you so much for joining us
again.
Thank you
so much.
It's really, really appreciated.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. The world is very different compared to a year ago. In the 12 months since the Russian invasion and the war began, we've seen NATO pull together and Europe united in its support of Ukraine. But while those things remain true, we've also felt the pain of sanctions placed on Russia domestically. And we're currently, obviously, in the middle of an energy crisis that shone a light on just how reliant we are on Vladimir Putin's country. I'm joined now by The Guardian security and defence editor Dan Saber, who back when the war first began, came on the podcast to talk about it then, so we thought it was a good idea to have him back now. Dan, obvious question to start with. I wonder to what extent you're surprised by how Ukraine has held together in this war and is still where it is. That wasn't our expectation when this war began. Our expectation, I suppose, was that it would be over sooner rather than later and that Russia would be dominant. And that obviously hasn't turned out to be the case.
Well, it certainly wasn't the case. If you look back as of 12 months, and I can remember actually, I was on the podcast, it was actually a day off the invasion and we did a slightly sort of emergency recording. I was in the Houses of Parliament, which seemed like the best place to be where you might be able to get some kind of emergency information. So I remember we did this recording at the time, and I think the fear at the time was that Ukraine would last only a matter of days.
Yeah,
I think the Russians thought 3 days, but I think maybe 10 days before the Russians would be able to sort of capture Kyiv and have a stranglehold at least on large parts of the country. Now that didn't happen, and what Ukraine showed in the very first instance was this extraordinary resilience, this extraordinary national mobilization, and that allowed it to fend off the Russian invasion in the first instance. What we saw very rapidly was also these sort of terrible Russian military tactics, this famous convoy that got stuck on the way to Kyiv. But since about April, we've been sure that Ukraine would survive on an existential basis, that President Zelensky wouldn't be killed in a bombing raid or a guerrilla raid by Russian forces. You know, and so the war took on a different complexion. So I think for maybe the last 10 or so months, we've been sure that Ukraine's going to survive. What we haven't quite been sure of, and we're still not sure of really, is, you know, what is the outcome of this sort of you know, increasingly international test of strength, and whether, Ukraine really can push the Russians back and inflict a significant military defeat on Russia, or whether Russia will be able to hang on to a large swathe of territory, currently about the size of Portugal, that it holds in Ukraine,
and whether
Vladimir Putin can claim some kind of victory.
I just want to ask you, what your sense is of where we are now. We've sent tanks, we train Ukrainian soldiers, we're being asked for jets. There is this sort of spectacle built into British politics now, which involves Boris Johnson, that Boris Johnson has positioned himself as this person saying more, 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 and Sunak, it is now, is standing there sort of caught in the headlights somewhat, not quite answering that call or not quite being seen to. Where do you think that is now?
Well, I think that, it's funny, that's right. Boris Johnson has sort of lost himself a prime ministership and found himself a role as an unofficial spokesperson for Ukraine, arguing for a more radical policy than he would have ever been able to achieve as PM. Look, the reality is that for all the talk of British sovereignty in the Brexit debate, but the reality is when it comes to military matters, you have to proceed as part of an alliance. And Britain is a significant military player, but still a medium-sized one at best in a world that's dominated by, of course, the US, but in which working in alliances is crucial. And teams only move as fast as their slower members. But so Britain's sort of taken on this role, which is about the best role it can take on, if truth be told, because whether you like it or not, you know, Britain is sort of increasingly underinvested in its military, has a limited to negligible land capability, which is what Ukraine particularly needs. And the Ukrainians know that as well. They can't really expect very much from Britain. The moral support, though, is very welcome. And, as long as that continues, that will count for something.
Let's talk about what might happen next. There is a lot of talk around, as you will know, about a renewed Russian offensive, the idea that Russia incrementally is advancing in certain parts of Ukraine and that something pretty awful is sort of imminently on the way. Do you think that's the case, that we're likely to see a ramping up of Russia's efforts in Ukraine now?
Oh, I think we'll see a ramping up, but a ramping up to no great effect. I've come back from Ukraine pretty recently. I was on or near the front line in not far from a place called Vuhledar in the east of Ukraine. So I was sort of down there in the freezing cold, -6 degrees in deepest Donbass, if you will. And what happened in Vuhledar, even when I'd arrived, was that essentially there'd been 3 weeks of Russian tank-led offensives against a tiny coal town. And the reality was that after 2 to 3 weeks, the Russians at point blank failed to capture it, lost dozens of tanks in the process. Why? Because they'd shown terrible tactics. They were lining up in a vertical file like they learned nothing from the failed assault from Kyiv and being spotted by Ukrainian drones from the air, allowing the artillery to pick them off. So this kind of terrible performance means that, Russia might attempt more of an offensive. It's got about 300,000 troops in the country at the moment, which is, by the way, double what it had to its initial invasion force, to give you some idea of the scale. But it's running its attack so incompetently in places like Vuhledar and in other places, most notably Bakhmut, where this is World War I style warfare with minimal to incremental gains at best. And so the idea that Russia's going to mount, has got some spectacular ace up its sleeve, I don't quite buy.
But then by implication, you're looking at grinding stalemate. Is that your expectation?
Well, there's one more thing that has to play out, perhaps before you get to that dismal point, which is, of course, meanwhile, the Ukrainians are being supplied with Western weapons, well over 100 tanks, mostly from German supplies, Leopard 2s and older Leopard 1s, though there are a smattering of British Challenger 2 tanks as well. So this could create a strong kind of mechanized force, the basis of any kind of military attack force for a kind of D-Day moment, sometime in the spring, before or after Easter, potentially. So I think there's a lot of expectation around that, and I think there's a lot of political hope around that. And if you sort of follow the prevailing drift of the political narrative, I think what all politicians are saying now is, we've given you the tanks, now President Zelensky, go and win the war. It's just not that simple. The Russians have got the numbers, 300,000 I've already talked about, are well dug in. But there is an obvious Ukrainian move, which is if they can split the so-called land bridge between Crimea and Russia proper, if you'd like, by driving down roughly on the map from a place called Zaporizhia to the sea, then that would place the Russians in a much more difficult position because it would split the lines of communication. But this is a big if. This is a big if.
When we spoke to Kira Ruddick, the Ukrainian Member of Parliament, before we began this conversation, she underlined something that I keep seeing in all sorts of places, which is the idea that because of the very, very precarious, damaged state the Ukrainian economy is in, chiefly, Ukraine is going to have to win this quickly if it's going to win. Before we get on to what winning actually means, but if it's going to get a decisive advantage, then that has to be established fast now. That's sort of where we are.
I think there's something in that. And what I'm saying is also there's a lot riding on it politically. If President Zelensky can achieve big results in the spring going into early summer with this Western materiel, Western military equipment, then it will appear justified. He will appear doubly heroic. And it looks like Ukraine has got the potential to win the war. The alternative scenario is clearly that doesn't really work out as hoped, or it takes much longer, or it's much more complicated. Then we're into something... neither side is achieving a decisive breakthrough. Fighting will continue in the autumn. Neither side are anywhere near wanting to make peace. And suddenly we've got a scenario that feels a bit less attractive. You know, the West is going to keep on supplying weapons and munitions because this is a proxy war.
But that's certainly what Russia might be hoping for, that if it can't produce a breakthrough now, it can sort of grind the West into submission and perhaps wait for political cycles to turn.
Let's hear little excerpts from the two big speeches this week, from what Vladimir Putin said, first of all. This is him talking about his sort of frame for the war in Ukraine, in the sense that it's a struggle on Russia's part against the West.
I would like to emphasize that it was before the special military operation they were negotiating the supply of heavy military equipment and planes and anti-aircraft defense systems. And they were also publicly talking about supply of nuclear weapons. NATO and Western countries were setting their military bases on our borders and biological laboratories, and they were training on the future theater of military actions.
If the war grinds on, do you think the way that Putin has framed it and the sense that enough Russian people are prepared to believe that, do you think that will be sustainable, or do you think that's already starting to fall apart in Russia?
I think it's sustainable. I mean, you had a sort of baffling mixture of nonsense and some truth there from Putin. This idea that the West is going to give Ukraine nuclear arms or biological labs is utter nonsense.
But what was the truth? What was the truth part?
Well, there is no truth to that. And as for arming Ukraine, that was essentially done in response to Russian aggression. Nevertheless, what Putin, I think, wants to say and can say is that Russia is right now engaged in a war with the West more broadly, because the West is supplying so much weaponry, and that this is a struggle, this is rhetoric that can play well to his own audience internally. And although there's no question, I guess Putin has been on sort of, is in greater threat, if you like, than he has been at any time in his sort of two decades of rule or in Russia, he doesn't look like under that much threat.
Okay, let's hear Joe Biden.
Autocrats only understand one word: no, no, no. No, you will not take my country. No, you will not take my freedom. No, you will not take my future. And I'll repeat tonight what I said last year in the same place. A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to ease the people's love of liberty. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
I'm interested to know your sense of how sustainable that kind of rhetoric is, if you think about the idea that the war conceivably may well grind on and on and on. We all know the strange state American domestic politics is in, and the fact that there are Republicans who are much more sceptical about the war and America's support for Ukraine than Joe Biden is, and so on.
Well, that's the crucial question, I think. I mean, for now, it's incredibly reassuring for Ukraine that Joe Biden's sort of taken this on as his principal foreign policy challenge after the catastrophe of Afghanistan, where, of course, you know, the US walked out after 20 years of war and gave the country back to the Taliban. So that was an absolute disaster. So here he's trying to portray, you know, not unreasonably, I think, actually, this war as a sort of a fight between freedom and a kind of autocratic, unattractive, even Bond villain Russia, or Bond villain Vladimir Putin. Then there's a kind of much more important question, which is, that's all fine during 2023. But as you said, the US electoral cycle looms. There's no question, I think, that if Donald Trump were to win back the presidency, at the very least, you would have much more erratic decision making around foreign policy. And that's putting it mildly, because you'll remember what it was like last time. And without US military support, Ukraine's stuffed. So I've just found some figures today. Germany's Kiel Institute, which tracks these things, has sort of got the US providing 44 billion euros of military support to Ukraine, and Europe, and I'm including the UK here, 18.7 billion. So, you could do the math. America, militarily, is everything. And any change or any dilution of this strong pro-Ukraine policy of the White House is going to be a problem for President Zelensky, and Vladimir Putin knows that.
Okay, let's talk about something which is cropped up sort of every 5 or 6 minutes in the conversation we've had so far, which is the question of how this war conceivably might end. It does seem that under the surface, perhaps, there's a divergence between Ukraine and its Western allies, in the sense that Ukraine insists that they intend to capture or recapture, as we said already, all Russian-held territory, including Crimea. Now, Western leaders and diplomats, as I understand it, don't disagree in public, but in private, they don't really believe that retaking Crimea is a realistic war aim. And I suppose bound up in that is the sense that sooner or later, negotiation has to rear its head. Belligerents in a war always imply sort of total defeat and the idea that they'll get what they want. But we all know that that isn't the way that most wars end. So in that sense, I guess I'm asking you what your expectation is, if you can be so bold. When it happens, who knows, but how it might conclude.
Okay, so I don't see it the way that you've set out in your question, which is you've talked about negotiations, which is it strikes me as a laughable proposition. So there is, I do not believe this war ends with a handshake between Putin and Zelensky, or even a treaty that they've both signed, and some sort of, you know, you fought a good war, but here's where we've ended up. The two leaders can't stand each other. The two countries are miles and miles apart and where they want to be. And both sides have got an interest in carrying on with the conflict. A much more realistic scenario to my mind is that we get a conflict that kind of, that firstly runs for a long time, that lessens in intensity from where it is now and drifts towards something around a kind of lines of control scenario with some moderately heavy fighting, but not as heavy as now. So there's some similarities to what happened in the Korean War, in the sense that the Korean War ended in 1953 and there's still been no peace deal. The difference is that I think the conflict between these two countries would be much hotter. And I very much hope this isn't the case, John, that we'll be having a conversation in a year's time about where we're at, because I think the conflict will be running on then, because there's just no prospect for a deal between these two countries whose leaders, leadership, and most importantly, whose peoples are miles apart.
But that cuts across what we said earlier, the idea that to secure any sort of dominance, Ukraine has to move to an advantageous position quickly. That's not going to happen. So, but you think that eventuality that you've talked about, which is a sort of grinding stalemate with regular flashpoints and so on, that Ukraine can exist meaningfully in the midst of a situation like that?
It can, as long as it gets, because it needs just not just Western military support, it also needs Western financial support, you know, just to keep its books balanced. But I mean, look, for sure. I mean, I've been to Kyiv, you know, many times, and you won't be surprised to hear that you know, life carries on in many ways pretty much as normal once you discount the air raid sirens and, of course, the occasional terrifying missile raid. So, yeah, can Ukraine, you know, function in this kind of state of full war or some lesser long-term state of semi-war? For sure it can. And so, you know, the fundamental point here, John, is we're moving to a very different world. We are moving to a world which has a higher level of conflict in it than it had previously prior to this war. And this idea that, or any idea that one side or the other is going to prevail, that there's going to be a peace deal, that we're going to move on and it's going to be like how it was, going to be much more like how it was, it isn't the case. And that has consequences for Western governments who have spent most of the last 20 years, in most cases, switching money out of defence and into health, and are going to be faced with the tough choice of maybe having to switch some money back into defence, which may be necessary, but may also be a hard political sell.
And to look back where we started, which is comparing where Ukraine is now relative to a year ago, the point is, as awful as that outcome might sound, that's hugely preferable to the worst fears that everybody had 12 months ago, isn't it? Because Ukraine survives.
Look, absolutely. And I think that, you know, embrace the counterfactual for a second and then sort of shudder with fear. I mean, imagine if Putin had captured Kyiv in a week or 2 weeks, if Zelensky had been killed, if Russian troops had been parading, as they'd hoped, down Kryshtatyk, you know, Ukraine's answer to Park Lane, or this would be a terrifying thought. And Russia would have felt emboldened and even more confident and able, thinking about threatening, well, Moldova, other European states, so on and so forth. But the difference, I think, where it could have been, nevertheless, is significant. And I think the idea that Putin would have taken Kyiv quickly is a terrifying one to contemplate. And even now, the reality is, I think, a bit harder than we'd like to imagine.
Right. On that note of sort of, it's not quite optimism, is it? But it's a recognition that things could have been immeasurably worse. Thank you for joining us today, Dan. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts, and even better, leave us a review. You might also want to listen to Politics Weekly UK's sister podcast, Today in Focus, where this week, Daniel Boffey tells the story of Denis Kach, who's believed to be the first Ukrainian soldier to be killed by Russian forces on the 24th of February 2022. And on Politics Weekly US with Joni Grieve, she'll be speaking to Susan Glasser of The New Yorker about why President Biden chose this week to visit Kyiv and what the future might hold for the US and its NATO allies. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Danielle Stevens, Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.